This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
On Monday, July 13th, the Ohio Controlling Board approved $1 million in emergency state funding to care for the 16 children who moved from the house on Omer Street in Hamden. On Tuesday, July 14th, a judge in Vinton County signed a gag order barring the Attorney General's office, the county prosecutor, the sheriff, the clerk of courts, and all defense counsel from making any public statement about the Siders case. One day, the state wrote a $1 million check to clean up the damage. The next day, a judge told the people who exposed the damage to stop talking about it. Back to back. Nobody in Columbus seemed to notice the contradiction. The gag order was filed by Lee Roberts Jr., the attorney for Gary Siders Jr. Gary Jr. is the mutant, the man, I mean, whose indecent exposure warrant brought deputies to that house on June 13th. Deputies were not looking for children. They did not know the children were inside. They arrived to serve a warrant on a man who allegedly exposed himself to members of the public four times in May. How nice. What they found instead was 16 kids crammed into a 12 by 12 foot room contaminated with human waste and insects. The filth, was so severe that first responders nearly fell through the rotted floor. Attorney General Andy Wilson called what they found pure evil. Sheriff Ryan Kane said his county's livestock were kept in better conditions than those children. Those statements are the basis for the gag order. Roberts argued they were inflammatory, too inflammatory. He argued they would prejudice the jury pool in a county of roughly 12,600 people. Judge Lania Featherwolf Rogers agreed. Or they're just calling it like it is. And somebody doesn't like it. Here's a part that should follow around the rest of the day. The gag order technically applies to Gary Jr.'s case, but its language restricts every agency involved in the investigation from speaking publicly. The AG's office, the prosecutor, the sheriff, the clerk, defense counsel, all of them, the two officials whose words prompted the order were describing what they saw with their own eyes inside that house. They are now legally prohibited from discussing it. A fair trial matters. That is foundational. Nobody with any understanding of the justice system disputes a defendant's right to an impartial jury. But a gag order does more than protect a defendant. It also determines who gets to speak and who has to stay quiet. And in this case, every official who might face a camera and be asked, how did 16 children live like this without anyone knowing? Just received a court order reason not to answer. We'd like to hold you accountable. We'd like to ask how this happens. Can't talk. We got a gag order. How convenient. How convenient. Because look, I mean, the evidence is there for Gary and the Siders. They're pretty clear cut what the hell was going on in that hellhole. It's not so clear cut how everyone around seemed to like pretend this wasn't happening or was unaware of it happening. And the public would like to know also why $1 million of their tax money is now suddenly going over here for this. I mean, good, the kids are getting help, but hey, imagine if we had caught this ahead of time. We'd like to ask you some questions. Can't talk, got the gag order. Who does the gag order benefit more? The people who, the system that failed these children and this family and humanity in general? Or the family that failed humanity in general and their own family? Or all of, I mean, it really protects accountability for pretty much everybody. It protects everybody from the world, from accountability. The mutants and the monsters that look the other way. 5 years before deputies stumbled into that house, someone knew, not vaguely, not through the rumor, through official court filings. In October 21, Gallia County Juvenile Court filed 6 truancy complaints against Elizabeth Siders and Gary Siders Jr. An attendance officer named Ronald Hammond filed the paperwork. 6 of their children, ages 7 through 13, were allegedly enrolled at Advil Elementary and had not shown up for a single day of the 21-22 school year. Not a week missed, not a month, the entire year. The complaints meant Ohio's legal threshold for habitual truancy. The school notified the parents. The attendance officer warned them in writing. Ooh, get that notice in writing. The court processed the filings. 3 months later, in January 22, the Gallia County judge named Thomas Moulton terminated every complaint. The reason? Written into the court journal. The Siders family was unable to be served. Their whereabouts were unknown. And that's really how the Siders seem to live their life, from what we can see. Just go off the grid. Don't turn in the paperwork. And you know what happens when they just can't find you? Well, that's where the story ends. They just can't find you. Unable to be served. We got other fish to fry over here, kids. So, sorry. 6 school-aged children disappeared from a public school system. A court documented it. And nobody, not the school, not the court, not Children's Services, asked the next question. Nobody flagged the disappearance of 6 kids whose parents could not be found. Nobody escalated. Nobody picked up the phone and called another county. The file closed. Somebody else's problem. Those truancy complaints sat in the Gallia County Court for 5 years. The Siders family moved to Vinton County. The 6 children named those complaints, along with the siblings born after the filings, allegedly spent their days in a room no bigger than a parking space. The system that documented 6 missing kids in 2021 never connected the system that found 16 hidden kids in 2026. This is the kind of question that until July 14th, a reporter could have put directly to the Attorney General's office. Did your investigation find the Gallia County truancy file? Did anyone in the state system ever connect the 6 children missing from school in 2021 to 16 children found in that house in 2026? Was there a handoff between counties? Was there a referral to Children's Services? Was there anything? Under the gag order, the AG's office cannot answer that question publicly. The prosecutor cannot answer it. The sheriff cannot answer it. The question still exists. The reporting is still public record. But the people in the best position to tell the public what went wrong and whether anyone is being held accountable for it are now prohibited from speaking. Oh, sorry, I wish I could talk. No, you're happy you can't now by law. The silence is not theoretical. It applies to exactly these questions, the ones that matter most. Gary Siders Sr. is 73 years old. Natural selection clearly doesn't work anymore. He faces 16 counts of child endangering. He's not in a jail cell. On July 17th, while being transported to a court hearing, Gary Sr. fell. Oh, shucks. They should have kicked him out into the gravel faster. Wait for an oncoming semi and whoa! Sorry, whoops, he fell out of the car. Looks like those 18, oh, can you back up? Beep, 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 back it up. Let's hit him again. Doctors at the nearby hospital determined he had a serious medical condition requiring specialized care outside the county. Who cares? His attorney, Dorian Baum, had already raised concerns about his competency to stand trial. Baum said his first impression, just looking at his client, was that he had concerns about Gary Sr.'s ability to understand what was happening or assist in his own defense. You think? Here's what happened next. Vinton County Prosecutor William Archer held a press conference. He stood in front of reporters and explained that if the county kept Gary Sr. in custody, Vinton County was legally responsible for his medical bills. And those bills, Archer said, could bankrupt the county. So the judge modified Gary Sr.'s $300,000 bond to a recognizance bond. Gary Sr. signed the piece of paper. He did not post a dollar. When he leaves the hospital, he wears a GPS tracker. State pays for it. Archer's explanation was not inflammatory. He did not editorialize. He did not call anyone names. He stood at a podium, described a financial reality, and told the public why a man accused of helping endanger 16 children was no longer behind bars. That's a prosecutor doing his job transparently. That press conference happened on July 8th, 6 days before the gag order. If the same situation arises with another defendant, if Elizabeth Sider's bond is modified, if another accused family member is released for medical or financial reasons, the public may never hear the explanation. The gag order does not distinguish between inflammatory commentary and routine transparency. It prohibits all public statements about the case, period. The next bond decision, the next competency ruling, the next procedural development, all of it happens behind a wall of silence. And the public learns about it only through court filings if they know where to look, if it comes out. The press conference where Archer explained Gary Sr.'s release was exactly the kind of government transparency that keeps the public informed about how its justice system functions. It was not a press conference designed to prejudice a jury. It was a press conference designed to answer a legitimate question from a community that deserved an answer. The kind of press conference that is now prohibited. The Vinton County prosecutor acknowledged at a control board hearing that the cost of caring for the Siders' children could bankrupt the county. Joel Potts, the state's chief governmental affairs officer for children and youth, told lawmakers that therapeutic foster care runs $150 to $250 per day per child. Vinton County's child welfare caseload doubled overnight when those 16 kids were removed. Can you imagine all the children that probably should be in that? And they have no money for it, and that's why they're all living in filth. There's more kids out there than just these 16. There may not be 16 in the house, but I can guarantee there are many more homes with children just like this in this county. Ohio approved $1 million to address the immediate crisis. Potts said more money will likely be needed. State Representative Bride Rose Sweeney said she didn't know how anyone could look at this case and claim the systems were working as intended. The systems are pretty much telling you they can't work as intended. We don't have money for it. Oh, you're putting these kids on us now? We've just been ignoring them for the last 18 years. Or however many years they were in the county. Because we can't afford it. Oh, now you want us to do something about it? Everybody shut up. Everybody don't talk. Gag order. Todd said the structural failures in Ohio's child protective system might go beyond money. You think? Legislators promised additional hearings and reviews until everybody forgets about it and moves on to the next story. We'll get around to that, guys. We gotcha. Those hearings can still happen. Legislators can still ask questions. But the people with the most firsthand knowledge of what failed in this case cannot contribute to the public record outside of court filings and sworn proceedings. The sheriffs whose deputies walked into that room, the prosecutor who has seen the evidence, the AG's office running the investigation, all silent. The accountability conversation that was building in the 2 weeks after the rescue just lost its most important voices. The grandparents, Gary Sr. and Christina Siders, those winners, were receiving state benefits. The county prosecutor confirmed that at a press conference. The grandparents were interacting with government systems enough to collect assistance, and yet the 16 children in the same household had no school records, no medical records, no contact with children's services. The adults were visible to the state. The children were invisible. Or were they? Or does the state just like to pretend they didn't see them, and now they can't talk about pretending to not see them? All 16 were born in Ohio hospitals, every single one. Elizabeth Siders, who was 15 when she married Gary Jr. in West Virginia with parental consent, gave birth to 16 children over the course of 18 years. Her attorney confirms she is the biological mother of them all. Well, that's what the attorney says. Ain't that special? Let's do a little DNA testing here, too. Let's see who dad is, because I question that it's all Gary Jr. I could be wrong, but who knows? Somewhere in a medical system, a record exists for each delivery, and not one of those births. Not the first one from a 15-year-old bride, not the fifth, not the 10th, not the 16th, triggered a system that went looking for those children afterward. This system is not designed to find children. It's designed to process them after someone else does the finding. Mandated reporting exists. It sounds lovely. It does shit. Truancy laws exist. Well, child checks exist. Children's services exist. But none of those systems are self-activating. They require a human being to pick up the phone, file a complaint, make the referral, and then to be funded and staffed, which is usually the next line of failure in this cornucopia of bullshit that we call child protective services in the United States of America. And when nobody does, and when the family moves frequently enough, stays invisible enough, keeps the kids hidden enough, the system sits still and waits for an accident. The accident came on June 13th in the form of an indecent exposure warrant. Gary Siders Jr. had not decided to take his junk out and allegedly show the neighbors. In May, no deputy would have knocked on that door. No officer would have found 16 children. No AG would have called it pure evil. No sheriff would have compared the conditions to livestock pens. And no judge would have needed to issue a gag order because there would have been nothing inflammatory to say. 16 children are in foster care across Ohio. The youngest is 20 months old. Several needed helicopter transport to trauma centers. One was intubated. The AG said that if officers had arrived 24 hours later, they would likely be dealing with deaths. Investigators say the oldest, an 18-year-old, cannot write her own name. Some of the younger children could barely speak when rescuers found them. And let's just be flat-out honest here. Most of them are effed for life. Because when you abuse someone to this level, you're never going to be okay. No matter what sort of treatment you get, how well-founded, how educated, how great, how fantastical, how gee golly, ain't this the wonderful thing in the world it is. When you live in a life that long, you're fucked. And the state that fucked them doesn't want to talk. Those children cannot advocate for themselves inside that house. They cannot tell anyone what was happening because some of them did not have the language to describe it. For 18 years, they lived in silence, not by choice, but because every system that was supposed to hear them never listened. For 2 weeks after the rescue, officials spoke publicly about what they found. The language was blunt. Some of it was harsh. Ooh. But it was also the only reason the public knew enough to start demanding answers. Why was a truancy file closed without follow-up? How were benefits collected while children went unseen? Why did the state need $1 million to care for kids its own systems never found? The gag order did not silence the children. They were already silent. It silenced the only adults who had to start talking. 16 kids spent years in a room where nobody could hear them. The gag order makes sure the public conversation about why goes just as quiet. Well, guess what? It's not going to shut us up. It's not going to shut up a lot of people. We're going to keep talking. We're going to keep shining the flashlight under the incompetencies of America. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Let's go over to another horrific story that's been making the headlines in this last week or two. The Siders, 16 children pulled from a 12 by 12 room in a rural Ohio home, some able to speak, covered in human waste. And the only reason anyone found them is because the father was out showing his junk to the neighbors, allegedly. How
fine
nice.
Individual.
Four members of the Sider family now face 64 combined felony counts, but the gag order just shut down the flow of information to the public. The grandfather walked out of jail because the county couldn't afford to keep him, and Gallia County had truancy complaints on six of the kids 5 years ago that were never actually served. We couldn't serve them. Next. Defense attorney and former prosecutor Eric Faddis is with myself and Robin Drake to help break all this down. I want to get to the gag order right away because obviously this is something that the attorneys for the Sider, for Gary Senior, Junior, one of them got into place here. Yes, of course, a gag order quite oftentimes does benefit the defendant. But I'm seeing this as a little more beneficial to the state. I'm seeing this as a little more beneficial to all the departments, all the places, all the people that are going to be asked the question, that are being asked the question, that are being pulled to task and saying, how the hell did this happen? How did these kids 5 years ago just, well, can't locate them, next? There was a lot of signs. And a lot of signs were ignored or forgotten about, or there wasn't staff to take care of them or whatever. There's a lot of excuses at play here as to how they got to this state. And that gag order, well, I can't answer those questions about that because there's a gag order. How convenient, Eric.
Exactly. You know, Robin was talking earlier about how you repair trust in a community. You talk about transparency. You talk about being forthcoming, things like that. This seems like the opposite of that. Because when you hear the allegations, there's automatically kind of a lack of trust in the systems and structures in place that are supposed to regulate society, like making sure kids are okay. And then instead of the avenue of the government saying, hey, let us show you what we did. Let us show you why we couldn't serve these truancy complaints. Let us tell you about, what we our actions. It's going to be the exact opposite. Like I said, oh, sorry, we can't talk about that. There's a gag order. My gosh, how can the public trust that other kids are going to be kept safe if these allegations are true and if they can't get any information from the government about it?
I mean, exactly. I think that's the big reason. Obviously, these kids have been found. I've been saying from the moment I heard this story, this is not a one-off case. Maybe it's a one-off that there's 16 of them in a 12 by 12 space. But it's not a one-off in terms of, oh, there's a couple houses down the road that got two or three kids. And there's a couple up that way that got a kid. There's a couple up that way and this way and that way that are living in these abhorrent conditions with mutant-like family members that are charged with being parents and raising them. And the county looks the other way. Well, there's nothing we can do. I mean, now that they have been called to task on this, they're like, we have no money to deal with this. So of course they had no money to deal with it to begin with. They're only like, shit, now our feet are being held to the fire and we're broke. It's really exposing a system, and I don't even say it's corruption, but it's ineptness. More than anything else. Like on paper, we have these systems. On paper, we have, okay, this happens, that happens. See something, say something. The do something is the part that's missed. And we get to the do something part, and it's like, well, yes, it is our job to do that, but we're understaffed, we're underfunded. We just lost track of that shit.
the gag order really gets me on this one right now because, again, that lack of transparency on a critical case like this. And Tony and Todd, I know I texted you last night, so I'm going to give props to my amazing daughter, who is a labor and delivery nurse for the last 6 years. And I said, I gave her this case. I said, what would you do? And here's what I got back. And I even asked her to come on the show. She said no. what she said was, they should have been flagged. So if she goes into a hospital, because we know she gave birth in hospitals, and that's what my daughter, first of all, my daughter was amazed that, that she gave birth in hospitals and this continued to happen because she said she's a walking red flag. All the nurses would have referred her to case management and social work consult. But here's the critical thing she kept saying throughout this. If she, the 15-year-old at the time, refused to talk, that becomes the big problem. You know, and we see this in sexual abuse, in S abuse cases as well, that if the victim won't talk, that's a problem. And then I said, what would you have done in this case? And because this is where that compassion of nurses really comes to bear. She goes, I would have pulled her aside. I would have pulled her aside. I mean, look at this human being right here. This is who my daughter routinely would reach out to. And any good nurse reaches out, especially in labor and delivery. They care so deeply about this. They pull them aside. They have conversations. They refer them to services. But if the other thing that happens in cases like this too, if they're hospital jumping, it falls through the cracks as well. But all that being aside, it's easy to make excuse, but now that you threw the gag order on it, to your point, Tony, who are they protecting using a gag order? Are they now aware of a deeper problem in one of these organizations that, you know, say, you know, I'm going to go glass half full on my nurses that I love so dearly.
Yeah.
They probably did say something, but then it fell through some crack either intentionally or because they're inept or maybe a bad combination of both.
Well, I mean, Eric, what does it take? I mean, it's one thing to pull somebody aside, but that person that's being pulled aside then has to want to accept the help. And fear. if they can't accept the help, if it's fear, if it's ignorance, I mean, look at this poor. I mean, I hesitate to say poor girl, but I do because she had all these kids. But at the end of the day, she was 15, and you know, basically, you know, well, I'm gonna get married here, and everybody. Adults around her, great idea. So the guy who, you know, basically statutorily did this to you at a younger age, we're going to celebrate this with marriage. It's everything failed around these people, but I don't know that failure is looked at failure in this part of the country. It seems to be more like another Tuesday. And that seems to be a lot of the problem here. So if you pull somebody aside, but they don't want to get the help, and there is technically nothing illegal, quote unquote, going on, what can you do? There doesn't seem to be a safeguarding society for any of this if the person doesn't want to get help until people are actually caught being harmed.
Totally, Tony. And we see that so much in a number of contexts. One context is domestic violence. You know, yeah. In those cases, there even is significant evidence of criminality. Yeah. And even then, it is difficult. You can't force help upon someone who's refusing it, even if they're refusing it out of fear or out of some other reason like that. And so, yeah, we just don't have a great system. And unfortunately, in the domestic violence context and other similar contexts, even if there's help offered, if it's refused, those things can tend to recur. They tend to play out over and over again in similar ways. And at least according to the allegations, it seems like that's what happened here with the multiplicity of children, the multiplicity of abuse and neglect that's alleged.
I'd also be interested too, because one thing that my daughter, as soon as I presented my daughter, the first thing that she said was abuse. I mean, the first thing that popped in her mind because of the ages involved here, right? She said just the law of averages say most likely this is going on. Pure conjecture, obviously innocent until proven guilty and all that, but that was her professional opinion just off the cuff. The other thing too that happens when they go into these hospitals is blood work is done. And they would have popped for any kind of bad things in her blood system as well, which also would have been reported to a caseworker. So that's why I'm really kind of curious about why the gag order, what was actually known, what wasn't passed along, because I think I'm glad they're investigating, but now I'm skeptical.
I mean, this really feels like a case where if you let peoples whose brains are incapable of making good choices. And I believe in this case, you probably have a good amount of that going on. You probably have extremely low IQ. You probably have mental health problems going on. God knows what else you may have going on here. Probably some genetic shit. Again, all conjecture that literally makes someone incapable of making good decisions. But we say, well, to each their own. You have your rights, you have your freedom, your autonomy. Is this more of a case where we're looking at not only just the depravity of these people, but really what kind of a system are we running here where we allow this to go on as a society and pretend and keep telling ourselves, oh, they'll make a good choice. And if they don't, well, then there'll be consequences. But we keep hoping for good choices. When generationally, for hundreds of years, you can trace families like this back, and it's the hills have eyes. And we're like, ah, well, that's their lifestyle. That's their choice. Do we really give a shit about the children? Or is it just we like to tell ourselves we do? I mean, it's an opinion question. It's not a legal question, Eric, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, it's such a tragedy when we're talking about children who can't protect themselves and who, at least according to allegations, whose parents are not protecting them, and they are at risk. What do we do? Does the government step in? And if so, how severely do they intervene? And does just having some, you know, lip service in place about, hey, there's a social services system and that they we can come try to protect this kid, but you know, are they going to then take the children, or are they going to say, hey, look, in this rural community or this remote community, this is how these folks live and live and let live. It's a hard, fine line. You know, we want to have appropriate protective intervention, and we also want to maintain liberty and personal choice. And those two constructs really can come in tension with one another when you see a case like this.
Be the attorney for mom here, Elizabeth, I believe is her name. What are you advising her to do right now? I could see a world where she turns on everybody and really, you know, saves her own ass to a certain extent. Because I do believe deep down, as much as I think, you know, it's deplorable and you do have a level of accountability here, and I do believe she does. But you got to consider the circumstances. Do you advise her? What would you say to her?
I think in this case, and I'm not typically in favor of clients becoming government witnesses and cooperating and turning on other people. I've just seen it not be helpful for the client and open in worms. In this case, though, I think absolutely. I think you look at the disproportionate share of responsibility among the actors involved. I think her share is quite low, according to reports, if they're true. And so I would say, hey, you got to come forward. You got to tell them what a nightmare it was living in there, and what how you were influenced, and what pressures were on you, and were there any threats made, and were there any collusion and them compelling you to do stuff because they had more money or they had the shelter or they had some kind of way to dangle that over your head. And then you really try to implicate the true bad actors in order to save that client.
Is there any way, what would you need as a prosecutor to have her on your side, and so she becomes the person going after all of them for abuse? What would you need to see, you know, would there, you know, physical evidence, statements, you know, what do you need as a lawyer to see to charge, if she wanted to charge the rest of the family for the abuse that she went through, you know, kind of, like you said, turning those tables, and now's her time to kind of take charge of everything and show what was going on, you know, because it wasn't a physical restraint, but maybe an emotional. What do you need to see for that?
It would be difficult to go on her word alone. There is just so much that is problematic within that household that her just saying, hey, yeah, you know, this other relative involved, they were actually the monster and I was just going along with because I had to. That's one thing. But gosh, if you had text messages, if you had photographs, if you had videos, if any of these children are competent to provide information that's consistent with what this young woman may have to say in terms of implicating other folks, that you would really want that as a prosecutor, and not just kind of her word in this nightmare scenario.
Well, the government has obviously closed ranks with their gag order of we're not going to talk about this, but there's a lot of people who witnessed this. I'm not saying anybody is, you know, legally accountable or responsible for this other than the people involved, the four of them. But there are a lot of people who did see these people around, you know, mandatory reporters and such. And mandatory reporting only means so much if there actually something is done after something is reported. We like to sit on that mandatory report and think, oh, this is going to solve the problem. Is there any accountability that you see here, or is there any liability, I guess, that you see here for anybody outside of government if things were not reported, if action was not taken, even though we know the answer is it would have gone to the county and the counties would have said, we're broke, it's all you, which they're doing now. Do you see anything going down that road in any way, shape, or form?
You know, Tony, a minority of states have what are called Good Samaritan laws.
Yeah.
And really the essence of them is if you see something horrible happening, you may have some kind of legal duty to do something, whether it's reporting it, intervening is not usually required. I don't know if their state has that law, but if it doesn't, the general rule is that if you know of something horrible going on, you're not legally required to come forward to police or to the government or to somebody else about that. You know, we don't impress that legal duty upon folks. Now, should they? Is there a moral duty? Is it, you know, that's an entirely different question.
Well, I mean, a lot of people have the moral duty and they follow it. It's just then it dies with the agencies that don't have the ability to do anything. Robin?
You know, and on this, I don't know why. Anytime we cover what may be a severe abuse of a woman, I really get wound up about it because this to me has got a lot of leakage of like Hillbilly Epstein going on. You know, is there any way? I'm sorry.
That's
is there
a
any
new term?
Every now and then, right? I have a moment. Is there any way? Say they could do DNA testing on the kids. Is there a way then that could then become evidence that she was unwilling with multiple partners, that it was forced upon her if you have multiple DNA? I'm just kind of going down. What roads can she do with a lawyer saying, because I really, if she was abused, and it's hard to imagine in my confirmation bias world that she wasn't at some way compelled to do what she really didn't want to do, like have babies nonstop in her entire life. What can you do? I mean, what can you do something like that? Would it help, not help?
Yeah, totally. You know, I think what you do is you start with the client and you say, hey, tell us how you might have been victimized, how you might have been forced to do things you didn't want to do. And then you take investigative measures to try to confirm or deny that allegation. And one of them, like you said, Robin, if she was forced to be with multiple partners with whom she didn't want to be and had children as a result of them, well, one way to find evidence supportive of that allegation would be to do a DNA test of the children. And oh, it's true that her kids are from multiple partners. That is consistent with her allegation that she did that. She was forced to do that against her will. And so, yeah, I think there are those investigative measures that can be looked into. And also, you know, I can't believe that no one else was aware of this. I think interviewing folks in the neighborhood, in the community, who may have had interactions with these people. You know, people need to buy things. They have to go to the grocery store. They got, you know, and I think that those information from those folks too can help either confirm or deny the allegations of non-consent and things like that.
And does a small court system like in this county have the resources to actually pay for DNA testing? I mean, how does that work?
Oh, potentially. I think that prosecutors with the appropriate cause could order DNA testing. Civil attorneys could pursue it, but they would have to be paid not by the state. Right. So, yeah, there is a funding question. Yes.
It's such a sad story. And it's just another one where it leads to, oh, look at this horrifically broken system we have that nothing ever gets fixed at. And it always seems to be broken at the same spots and the same problems and nothing ever changes. Wonder why that is.
Makes you cry.
Yeah, I got some suspicions. That's going to wrap up our episode. Eric Faddis, as always, thank you so much for coming on and giving us your insight. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, his latest book, It's Not All About Me, available wherever you get books and audiobooks. Leave a review there on Amazon. That's greatly appreciated. And your thoughts in the comments section on Substack YouTube. Links are in the description. Be sure to hit subscribe so you don't miss any of our coverage of these horror stories. Until next time, for Robin, for Todd, for Eric, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Peace.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.